This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Hello, good morning. I'm Noel Lim. DPI Holdings is a leading homegrown manufacturer of aerosol and spray paint products for cars, motorcycles, decorative and do-it-yourself projects. DPI supplies more than 300 colours to over 700 distributors and retailers in Malaysia, and they have clients in Indonesia, Singapore, Japan, Australia and New Zealand. We speak with Adam Chai, the Deputy Managing Director of DPI. Is listed on the ACE market and is valued at about 200 million ringgit. Adam, welcome to the show. DPI, like many businesses, were affected by the MCO. Last year, sales were down to 42 million ringgit from 49 million ringgit a year ago. But your quarter ended February 2021 is about 16 million ringgit. Could I extrapolate that figure and say annual sales will be about 64 million ringgit, a record year?
It's difficult to say where we'll end up at, but I think you can use that as a good guess, a way to good guess where sales are leading, but it's on the up as compared to what we have the year before and even 2 years before. It's a pleasant surprise for everyone.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a record sales year. What would drive sales?
Maybe I'll just go back into a bit on the COVID 2 months of total no sales. But if you can check back during that quarter, despite the fact that we have 2 months that we couldn't do anything, we still recorded a small profit. So there's also a slight increase in demand for DIY products and activities in local because people had more time to do things around the house. But what we didn't see coming was that post-COVID, that basically business demand actually went up. And actually more, there was no more demand for our goods. Part of this was due to disruption happening around our region and even around the world. Shipments were getting delayed and the prices of shipment, as you know, has gone went up by 5 times or 6 times. But every time when there's a crisis, there's a financial crisis or even the Lehman Brothers crisis and everything, there's a slight dip in the revenue. But after that, we almost always come back very strong.
Is there like a new business that will be driving this sales up, or what is it that's driving the underlying demand?
Our business makeup, 80% is local business and on our own brand. And then we've got 20% that's doing OEMs as well. So that's doing OEMs and export. And that is a big constituent of our business as well. There's potential for growth in that. During this period of time, where we have all these disruptions, a lot of the local big brand owners or even international big brand owners to be specific, right, are looking for people like us around the region that can do contract private label packaging for them around the region. And in Malaysia, at the scale that we know how to do aerosol paint and coatings and industrial aerosol, so we are the only one at that scale that can do that around this region. And some of them used to be buying from China or some other regions. But due to the current political developments play a part, COVID disruptions playing a part, so they have been relooking and decentralizing their whole supply chain strategy. And also, compliance costs in China has gone up by a lot.
These international brand owners, who are their ultimate buyers? Is it the construction side, infrastructure, shipping, oil and gas, for example?
I've got a large spectrum of users. One of the sectors would be aerospace, which is quite subdued, but they have all along, prior to the aerospace activity going down, they have always had very good demand. And then we have the oil and gas as well, and then we also have construction as well. And these are all niche products that not everybody knows how to do. And we are in it because we've got the technical expertise doing coatings for a while. I mean, technical expertise doing coatings and technical expertise doing aerosols, those two need to come together in order to come up with a final product. We've been doing this for a long time now for some Japanese companies. So we've got a portfolio, we've got references, customer references. We've been doing this.
You mentioned about compliance costs has gone up in China. Could you elaborate what that cost is?
What happened in China today is that they've been forced out the value chain. Their labor cost is no longer cheap. It's expensive to hire someone from in China at this point of time. I mean, labor in Malaysia is way cheaper than it is in China. So what happens is that the government is actually not trying to force out a lot of these industries which they consider high value products. They try to go more into high value products. So a lot of all these companies, aerosol companies in China, they used to be located near the town areas, but they don't want that anymore. So they're forcing them into chemical processing zones. But in order to go into those chemical processing zones, you need to be of a particular size and economies of scale to be able to go down there. So all those small, medium companies are slowly disbanding or finding alternate ways to manufacture, some of them illegally for the short term. But going long term, a lot of them would eventually fade off and you will be left with a few big ones. And they have to be located within that chemical processing zone. And the cost of testing to make sure that you're compliant year after year, and of course, the people you have to employ in place, the safety officer, everything. All, they have a lot of all this coming in. We know this because we've been speaking to them, engaging them as well, during even way before we got listed.
When some of these aerosol players, when they maybe go out of production in China, do you see opportunities for yourself to go in? Although understandably, the labor cost may be higher there, but you're going to be closer to your clients.
There's certain benefits being close to that market and supply chain. It's a huge market, but it's a hugely competitive and difficult market as well. You can go in and work with someone. Do they improve our overall competitiveness? Do they expand the range of products we currently offer? Third thing, do they expand our distributor reach?
Vietnam has been touted as a beneficiary of this US-China trade war. Do you foresee that Vietnam is an interesting market for you, at least to set up an operation plant there or just to scout out any potential competitors?
Yes, we've been speaking to parties around the ASEAN, that region as well. It's a very good and interesting market. A lot of companies actually moved out of China. They do go into Vietnam. And with the population growth, it is a place that we look for to work with existing parties inside that market and see whether we can make something, get something going.
Is the cost of labor still much cheaper than Malaysia?
I think it's about the same. $250 to $300, you know, something like that. So it's about the same. The market is bigger.
It is interesting that the cost of labor in Vietnam is the same in Malaysia for general workers. How do Malaysia and Vietnam wages compare to China then?
Well, China is a lot higher now. China, if I don't, just a general worker, you have to pay 4,000 RMB, general worker, at least.
Okay, 4,000 renminbi is about 2,500 ringgit.
You go to China because you know you have a huge market. Those countries, you're there because they have a huge market. And then if you go into manufacturing in those countries, you offer a wider spectrum of products.
Your labor is mainly foreign or local? Yeah, like you're the general worker.
100% local. We are very happy. I'm always very happy to say that all my workers are local. Then I'll go to my factory and say, hey, all our workers down here are local Moarians, which is something that a lot of my business associates will say, oh, very envious. You have a lot of quota to hire foreigners and then you never hire. Can you sell me your quota? And I say, no, cannot.
What's the reason behind hiring 100% local workforce?
Just very comfortable with managing the local community to make all this. And all along for the past 40 years, I got very decent folks working for me for a very long time, and they're very comfortable, very down to earth, very grounded. There's no complexities. When you manage a foreign workforce, there are complexities that you have to manage. We can, if we want to, you just have to be prepared to manage those complexities. We used to have a factory. This is another business venture years ago in China, and we have foreign workers coming in, or rather workers from other townships coming in. So we have workers from other townships, Hunan, Hubei, Sichuan coming in. Then you have to provide hostels for them. You have to house them. Then when they cook, sometimes they get into fights and things like that. So there are complexities you have to manage when you hire a foreign labor. But let's put it this way. We can do that if we want to. And if we are getting into a situation where we see a quantum leap in our business development, we'll bring in the foreign.
It is inevitable as you also have to deal with inflationary pressure. For example, your raw material is the byproduct of petroleum. How easy has it been for you to pass on the cost by charging higher average selling prices?
Everyone will be looking at rising costs going forward. It's not just going to be my business, especially ever since we had the shipping disruptions, transport shipping, all those costs goes up, all those adds in. At the end of it, we are also very lucky, honestly speaking, because we have a brand name that's been around for a long time. We will need to increase prices at some point when the costs go up, right? And throughout the years, in 40 years that we've been in business, we've been able to generally increase our prices. And because prices of solvents are crazy, they've gone up by two times. Shipping has gone up by 6 times. Everything has gone up.
How much did your average selling price go up by this year?
Well, let's just say 10%.
This is The Breakfast Grill, and I'm speaking with Adam Chai, the Deputy Managing Director of DPI, an ACE-listed leading manufacturer of aerosol and spray paint products in Malaysia, and they have clients in the region. After this, we'll discuss growth plans.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. Adam Chai, the Deputy Managing Director of DPI, joins us. In a recent interview, your father, the founder of DPI, said that the company will also grow through acquisitions and joint ventures like one in Australia and Japan. But I understand it is not easy negotiating with family businesses and SMEs. What's the usual difficulties? I ask this question because it could hinder your growth.
Yeah, like what you say, it's not easy to talk to family businesses about M&A. So to date, I think we've spoken to no less than 10 parties, a lot of them. And of course, when you build your business over a spectrum of like 30 years and suddenly you're at the end of it and you want to let go, there's always a lot of thoughts coming into mind. Should I hang up my boots and call it a day to the business owners? The other more important part of it is that they want to hear what development you have for their company and for themselves going forward. I think that's the key. If they are not interested in that story, then most likely their business is not worth much. So during this one past year, we've got quite a few parties that we're speaking to, but we can't really announce or say anything much about those developments until they become more concrete. But we do have some in the pipeline.
How long do these negotiations typically take?
Some of the parties, we've been speaking to them for about 3-4 years. The good thing is that those people who are in a position to really wait a long time for you to say, who can wait a long time to tell you yes or no, are good businesses. We are not only speaking to one party anyway, we are speaking to a few parties.
So you and your father own about 74% of the company, and you're obviously quite interested in looking at businesses where the current owner may want to come in as a shareholder. So would this mean that you and your father may give up some of your stakeholding?
Yeah, we're comfortable to do that if it's required. I think it makes some sense to do that if, let's say, we have some really very strong parties, alliances that we can build. In the listed shareholding structure, we're still considered quite young. We don't really know what kind of strategies are better than the other. But it is something that people have suggested to us to look at. But it depends on who is coming in. And for every company, it's different. Some of them, even if you want to buy them, it's very difficult. That do not meet the compliance requirements of a LISCO. Just to give an example, their current operation place do not have like the licenses in place. Or for example, they've been selling this product for such a long time and they never registered a trademark. Then we cannot buy, because what are you buying over? You're buying over this brand, but they don't have a trademark. Sometimes they register a trademark. The trademark is under their grandfather's name or somebody else's or close relative's name, and that person is no longer around. Then they are all stuck.
Still on growth, earlier you had indicated that the OEM business is really picking up. The current ratio is 80% own brand sales and 20% from OEM. Do you expect this ratio to change?
Eventually, it'd be nice to get shift to 40-60 or 35-75, but it depends. So one thing good about OEMs is that they've already got the distribution networks.
Looking at our other manufacturers like the rubber gloves and condom makers, many of them actually started as OEM. Then eventually they want to do their own product. And sometimes it's complicated because if you've signed something with your OEM clients, it may prevent you from launching your own brand names. Do you foresee one day you may acquire a party that's downstream? So you have control over the distribution network.
I won't rule that out. I mean, we've spoken to parties before, but not within Malaysia itself. We went to Burma a couple of times or so last time, but you know, certain things happen, then you just put that on hold and then you move on to other markets and see whether there's other development that's good for us.
There are a lot of concerns or interest in ESG, environment, social and governance. Now, how do your products stack up when it comes to environmental friendliness?
Well, our products all along has been CFC free. So when we manufacture our products, we make sure that there's no wastage. And within the product development spectrum, we're also looking at a non-LPG gas propellant or propellants that's non-flammable. But it will increase the cost of the product that you're going to market out. So it's got to be a good product that you're willing to pay for, consumers are bothered enough to pay for it.
Are Asian customers willing to pay more for completely carbon-free products?
For industrial products, it's not so significant, to put it that way. But actually, our product is getting a bit more of a lifestyle product. They usually use our products when they want to do something really nice and good, put it that way. If they're going to use it for marking, just a very general marking, they're just going to buy the cheapest thing around. They're just going to use it for marking. So there's different sectors in the market that we are looking at. I personally, that sector appeals to me. The lifestyle users who are very conscious about social responsibility, it appeals to me, but it's not a significant part of the market. But I will get into that space if I can. I just wish that at the end of it all, I can produce something that is socially responsible and people will want it.
Chinese businesses like to have like three legs, three businesses, yeah. More stable. So you have aerosol and you have spray paint. Do you have like a third main leg in mind?
I think that is also a possibility. My father is a serial entrepreneur. He just loves business, loves developing business. So he has got into a lot of different businesses through the past three plus decades of his career. So he will buy companies. In actual fact, he didn't have time to teach me about business. So he bought over a business in China, in Shenzhen, and said, hey, you just go and sort this out. So it was an aerospace company. So actually, I'm quite familiar with the aerospace industry. So I've been in industrial businesses, industrial manufacturing businesses. He has some water business, interest of manufacturing of mineral water. So there are a lot of different businesses that we come to. But I think at this point of time, when I speak to him, I say, you have to sweep away those that you totally have no interest and just focus on what you want to do. Because when you focus on too many different things, you don't get that synergy and economies of scale of building that business that you're interested in. And happy to say that we failed a lot in the past. So for all those failures, you already know some of those businesses, if you go into those businesses, it's not going to generate the revenue and the profit you need. So don't waste time. So from that, to answer your question, yes, we will go into a third one if it's but it has to be something that brings a lot of synergy to what we're doing. Say I want to go into the lifestyle sector more, you know, I want to pivot more into the lifestyle sector, then I go into a toy business, then I find some synergy down there, then maybe yes. But I'm not going to just get into a business just because it sounds great.
Your father started out as a cleaner, waiter, bar cashier, building materials salesman and building contractor. Then he was based in Indonesia for Nippon Paints. Quite a colourful career. So what's the most important lesson you learned from your father when it comes to running a business?
Firstly, never give up. And then secondly, lead a frugal living, I guess. That's one thing that's from young to old. He's always lived by that rule. That's a difference though. You know, stingy and frugal, they are two very different things. Stingy means that you don't spend on other people, but you spend on yourself. People ask you to go out for a nice meal, you don't spend. But you yourself, you go ahead and eat. You go ahead and spend as much as you can. So that is stingy. Frugal is you don't spend anyhow spend money outside and you don't anyhow spend money on yourself. So that, to me, is frugal. And I think that's quite an important quality. Of course, from young, I would not understand that. When I was in my youth, I would think that, hey, we can buy the nicest car. Why don't we buy the nicest car? So up to today, I mean, I will always tell people, he's still driving the 30-year-old Honda Accord. I tell him it's not safe. I need to change it. He said, you don't need. So that's frugality. So all along, I always think that, I used to think that frugality is a very tough attribute to live by. But then that's one day I read Jeff Bezos. He had this core value statement. Frugality breeds resourcefulness. So I thought that was quite an interesting way to look at it. So when you're frugal, when you don't have all the resources in the world and you need to make things happen, you need to be smart in how you use your resources to make the most of what you have, and you become a better person.
Thank you for speaking with us, and all the best. Adam Chai, Deputy Managing Director of DPI Holdings. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.